How hard is it to write roles for a film when you're also the one that's acting? Hi, my name is Marco and welcome to another episode of the Storyline Sessions podcast. My guest in this one is Kelton White. He's a screenwriter, actor, and the director of multiple award-winning short films. In our talk, we've covered his transition from writing novels to writing scripts, challenges of indie filmmaking, the process of creating a feature from a short, and many more interesting topics. So, get comfortable and let's get into this week's Storyline Session with Kelton White. Enjoy! Hi, Kelton. Welcome to Storyline Sessions. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing awesome. Good. I'm glad we could connect. It took us a few tries, so but I appreciate you being in.
It did, of course. Yeah. No, thank you for having me. I'm really excited.
Same. Just like a fun fact, you're the first one of my guests who's actually a scriptwriter. Most of the people were writing prose books, short stories, that type of thing. So you're breaking the ice for people who are in film.
Oh, exciting. Well, I'm nervous to be that pioneer, but I'll take it. But yeah, and I checked out some of the other stuff that you guys have, and I listened to their work with the books and the fantasy and stuff, and it sounds so interesting, so I'll definitely check that out.
I'm glad. So yeah, let's just dip into your background. You're a man with many hats on your projects. You're an actor, director, but one of the things that's most interesting to me is a writer. So how you got into that? What was the first thing that drew you into film and then you from there picked up on the other stuff?
Yeah. So that's kind of a long story, but we have the time, so I'll take the initiative to go into it. Essentially, I grew up loving to write, but I always wanted to work in film, and I always loved films. But I grew up in Arizona, and I didn't know that pursuing film was a legitimate, like, what could be a legitimate thing. And so what I started doing is I actually started writing, and I would start writing little books, little stories. And during that whole time, while I was writing the stories, I was more imagining. I enjoyed the writing process, but I was more imagining, okay, what would this look like on screen? As a little child, I gave myself the permission to imagine what it would look like on the big screen, just some, wild dreams. And so I started writing that. So actually I have more of a background in writing books and writing stories. And I had published a book as a younger man. And so I went through that route, but my passion was always film. And then from writing prose and writing stories, I then went into writing theater plays and did a lot of theater in Arizona. And then about 7 years ago, I moved out to Los Angeles and I tried to do the whole acting thing. Still am struggling in doing the whole acting thing. But I knew ultimately it was because I just wanted to contribute to good stories. And so I was like, well, I have this background in writing books, and I have a pretty it's a pretty humble background in theater. Let me try my hands at adapting that into writing films. And so I started with short films, and my very first one that we shot went so horribly that it will never see the light of day, But that was so exciting because it was a moment where as a writer, but then also, a director and stuff, but definitely as a writer, it was this moment of, okay, I just got kicked off the horse. Am I going to get back on the horse? And am I going to try to do this again? Or am I going to kind of wipe my hands clean of this? And thank God I ended up getting back on the horse because I really enjoy where I'm at now. And even though it's still a struggle, really enjoy that. And so that's kind of my background and my journey to writing films now.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. I'll need to just jump back on the bit that you wrote a book. what genre was it? How did that look like?
Yeah, it's sci-fi fantasy. And I wrote it when I was a much younger man. And then it took a long time to get published, but it's called the Mysterious Files of Mr. Chimes. And you can get it on like Amazon and stuff, but they have like limited prints of it now, and so it's like ridiculously expensive because it's like super limited. It did not do well, but between you and I, and of course the audience, I was I was a young man who was still learning a lot about writing. And while I'm thankful for that time, I look back, I have a copy of it on my shelf, and I look back and I sometimes read those pages and I'm like, what was I doing? What was I thinking? while that can be embarrassing sometimes, it's also nice to know, like, oh, this is how far I've come. You know, this is where I started. And it's kind of eye rolly. It's kind of like, oy vey, like this is brutal. And then it's getting all the way to, oh, I've come this far. And that's kind of, it's a nice way to, it's a nice reminder. So yeah, I wrote that when I was a younger man and learned a lot since then.
And you've done a lot of different things between genres. We'll get into each of them. But how is the process of writing, like prose writing a novel, different for you than writing shorts? And in the future, like I'm sure you've done some longer scripts. How the process differs from project to project for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I struggle in my scripts. I'm way too descriptive. I love being descriptive because coming from that world where it's like you want to, you know, describe things and you want to paint the picture for this, you know, for the reader, my scripts go way over there. You know, a script that should only be 80 pages, 80 to 90 pages is all of a sudden 130 pages because I'm being way too descriptive and I'm painting the script in this decorative language. And so that's different. I've definitely had to learn to peel back that way. And then besides, when you write a book, you write the story, and then, you know, you'll have an editor or a publisher and they'll give you some feedback. But their feedback, and I could be wrong, like everyone's journey is different, but at least for me, the feedback was more grammatic, you know, it was about your grammar or, you know, small changes here and there. But for the most part, what you write, the book you write is the book that people are going to read. When writing for films, short films or features, they say, you know, there are three... There, when you're making a movie, there are three versions of that movie. There's the movie that you write, there's the movie that you shoot, and then there's the movie that you edit. And that's been really interesting, knowing when I'm writing a script, I'm imagining the script this way, but I also know that then when we shoot it, there's a huge chance that it will look completely different. In a really good way, in a really exciting way, in a way that, like, maybe the DP, the director of photography, has brought in their vision, or the crew, their vision, the actors, like their vision. Everyone is collaborating. Hopefully you've made a collaborative set where everyone is working together to create a different version of what you wrote. And then the editor gets their hands on the film and makes a different version. And hopefully if you've done your job well and you've gathered, you know, really talented people, you still come out with a really good film. But that would be the huge difference, is when writing a script, knowing that this is only the very first stage of this story. This might not be what the viewers see completely, rather than, you know, a book, you kind of write it and then you have the changes here and there. But for the most part, it's, you know, you put it out there and that's what you intended. And film is slightly a little bit different that way.
And how did you feel for the first time you had to let go of the control of that part of the process? I can imagine it could be tough.
Yeah, it really can be. It really can be. Fortunately for me, especially with my short films, I cannot gush about my post-production team more. Like, they are just so great. My editors, I have this editor, Zach Bender. He does incredible work. And then our sound re-recording mixers, they all just do such great work. And so when I pass off, you know, color gradus, all that stuff, like really just an incredible team. The very first time I passed it off, I was in good hands. I was fortunate enough to be in good hands. Oh gosh, what is this film now? This is completely different. It was like, wow, oh, this is different than I intended, but this is really exciting. And so I was fortunate that way. And I'm sure a lot of people don't have that experience, but for me, I felt very lucky to be in good hands. And that's just been really exciting. And what I've learned through that process also is to, and everyone's journey is different, especially as a creator, everyone's journey is very different. But when imagining something, when writing something, you almost have to, you want to hold on to it dearly because you want it to mean something to you, but then you also need to have loose hands on it because something's going to happen. When I imagine this scene in my film, we might show up to set and something, and this piece of furniture can't be moved, and all of a sudden that's changed things, or this person didn't show up and whatever. So we have to, you know, we have to adapt. So I have to keep my vision in loose hands and be game for it to change a little bit. Even it still stay with the core intent, you know, but be okay with it changing. And the same thing goes with editing and that process of giving it to others. Holding the intent very close so that you always remain loyal to the vision, but also at the same time letting it go and letting it change into something that this other person might have really good thoughts on and you never even considered. So I've learned that. I would say I didn't learn that the hard way, which is great. I learned that the really comforting, loving way, because I gave it to people who just knew really how to do it well, and I was very fortunate in that regard. So, but it's still a lesson to be learned.
Yeah, for sure. But it sounds good that you managed to do it that way. And you mentioned a vision a couple of times, and I can absolutely understand that. But when we think about you are independent, but still when working in different genres, how much of your vision is impacted by something that's happening on the market? Of course, you're not working for a studio in that way, so you need to deliver exactly what they want. But how did that clashes with the things you want to make?
Yeah. Oh, gosh, that is an incredible question. I think an artist definitely doesn't want to be like, oh, well, I'm just chasing a trend, because there is that feels fake, and you want to be true to what you want to create, and that's absolutely valid. But there's also an element where you kind of have to find the middle ground. You have to keep true to your vision, but then you also have to make sure this will be seen. This is, you know, right now the world wants to see this. The world wants to see XYZ. Let's give a little bit of XYZ, but let's leave room, or let's give a little bit of, you know, X and Z, but let's give a little bit of room for Y to sneak in there or whatever, you know? And so right now there is a really, really exciting push in film and TV, and then even I'm sure with novels and whatnot of this mash of genre. We're seeing it with one of the shows that comes to my mind right now, which I personally really love, is Barry, which is a Bill Hader HBO show, and that mixes comedy and drama so well in ways where both are not compromising. But they still go really well. The dramatic episodes, the dramatic moments are brutal, and they're so tough. And then the comedy is really, really funny. And we see that in movies as well, where we just have this blending of genre, and not in a way where, oh, there's a horrific moment and a character does a little one-line joke, so it takes the audience out of it. No, we don't want that kind of weird whiplash. Instead, they just come together and they dance really well. And so I feel like right now what the world is enjoying is this blend of genres, and I try to reflect that in my work. I try to reflect that in, you know, oh, here's a creepy short about friends in a cabin, but there's also some wit to it. Or here's a supernatural mystery, but there's a character that's, you know, witty and broken and might say a few things that are funny. Or here's romance, my very first one, here's romance and sci-fi, blending it together, you know. So I think that blending of genres is a way that I try to reflect what's on the market, I guess, right now, and what the world is interested in, if that answers the question.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. I was thinking about, I just recently, like a couple of days ago, saw a podcast that where one author talked about genres in the blending, and like a lot of people are watching when they think about genres, like different fruits, like here are oranges, here are bananas, but in actuality, a lot of things are just different types of apples. So the genres are more like different types of one fruit and not just like completely different things. So
That's amazing.
It made a lot of sense, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I really like that. And as we mentioned, you've done a lot of stuff, and I'll soon get to especially the one with the horror in the cabin. Oh, yeah. That's the one that I first discovered. And where I first discovered your work was YouTube. And I can imagine that like the possibilities that you have with that are quite different than some things that were just like a decade ago, let alone much before that. And how do you look at that platform? Of course, you want to get into theaters, you are in festivals, we'll talk about that as well, but what has YouTube meant for you?
Yeah, so I'm actually in the earlier stages of trying to use YouTube for my benefit. In the beginning of the year, I was doing these videos of people keeping updated through our production, and I need to get back on that because I really want to keep doing that. But what I've noticed about things like YouTube doing things differently than, you know, the studio, like you said, you know, 10 years ago it was like you have to go this route, and now all of a sudden there are different routes to go through, is that YouTube provides a chance for creators to be authentic and vulnerable with their audience. And I think as we go forward and as studios get more hold of productions and start using AI and you know, all these other reasons, I think authenticity will be the currency of the future. I think people will really appreciate when they can actually connect with the creator on a very personal level. And I think platforms like YouTube really allow that, allow that ability to interact with the audience and then interact with the creator and have this authenticity that you might not get with the, you know, a few days ago we just had the Oscars, and it's like, look, I don't want to pass judgment on any kind of authenticity there, but it's the lights and the camera and we don't really know who these people are. And YouTube offers a way to strip that away and be like, hey, here's the struggle. And one of the things I did earlier this year with my YouTube channel that I want to get back onto is the Filmmakers Fight, which was here in LA and LA, New York, Atlanta, New Mexico, all these places where this industry is popping up, the filmmaking industry is popping up. It's so easy to present yourself as this best version. And I'm a filmmaker and I, you know, this is happening and we're in talks with this person and whatnot. And that's all great, but it's like, it's so brutal and it's so tough and it's really, really hard. And so I wanted to offer an authentic look into that. So that was kind of my idea for going onto that. And yeah, I think it'll be interesting with YouTube and other platforms going forward, because we just got out of a strike a few months ago, and an actor's strike, and that took a long time and that really shut down the industry, and we're about to possibly go into another one for IATSE, and which might shut down the city again. And it was really interesting because it took longer than they thought it would. And there are many reasons for that, and I'm not a very intelligent person, and so I probably don't know more than half of the reasons why it took longer. But one of the reasons that I kind of hypothesized in my own unintelligent mind was that Hollywood and the big studios, they're not necessarily needed anymore. When they shut down, when a strike happens, the audience that they used to have a hold on is like, okay, well, this other person is doing the same thing and they're making really good content that I really enjoy. Or, oh, this independent studio that doesn't follow your rules and lives by their own kind of rules, they're also making really good stuff. So I'm going to go watch this. There was less of an urgency to get Hollywood back on its feet because of independent film or independent platform or other, you know, other platforms giving out content, certainly. But hopefully not just content, but actual good, you know, film and story and art. So I think we'll see more of that. I think we'll see Hollywood, places like Hollywood will never leave, will never be gone, but I think it will lose some of its power as platforms like YouTube and other platforms provide people with not just, you know, the quick content, but with actual works of art and actual beautiful stories. That was a huge tangent. I hope that kind of answered the question.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you mentioned other platforms as well, and for sure I started off from YouTube when I asked you about that, but definitely, whether it be authors, filmmakers, a lot of people have been investing themselves to bring that authenticity, as you said, to the audience, and mm-hmm. people have been responding to it, and self-publishing in books and mm-hmm. crowdfunding is a huge thing, and recently we've seen on both Bookfront people amassing large amounts of money for books, deluxe editions, purely from their fan base and from people who care about their work without any studio, publisher, whatever involved. And coming to like past few years, we've increasingly seen that in film as well. I think that, okay, it's more difficult because a lot of more people need to be involved in making a film. But still, for me, it was interesting seeing that Chris Tuckman, the movie reviewer on YouTube, has done crowdfunding for his upcoming movie. Which was really interesting, and that he basically, if I understand correctly, most of the film was financed by the audience, and also seeing that like a lot of indie authors in that space, like Skinamarink, which was kind at one point a hidden gem, which exploded into the internet, and now it's basically mainstream, everybody has heard of it, but it's kind of a $10,000 or whatever budget. So it was amazing seeing that kind of film. And that's to your point that you said authenticity in the future will be increasingly valuable, as you see that kind of movies are getting more and more space in like media coverage, not just only between fans. So it's interesting seeing that.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, totally. And Kickstarter, Seed and Spark, all these platforms that are helping creators get ahead and also invite people in. People want to be, especially with things like Seed and Spark and their incentives and stuff, people, I find, even people not in the arts, like kind of want to be involved and it's really sweet and they want to help out, especially if they have faith in the person trying to, you know, or the team trying to raise this money. And so I think that's an absolutely valuable thing. And like you said, it's different slightly with like film or pilots or whatnot, because with writing, with like a book or something, that's so much work. And on a few individuals, that's so much work. With like film, it's a whole crew and everything. And so usually, there's even more money that you have to raise. So it's pretty intense that way. Absolutely. There are pros and cons to both.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, when you think about it, like for books, Kickstarters that are worth a couple of millions are a huge success, and for a movie that's like a small movie, so it's not something that we would like, wow, that's a huge budget. Now, when you have films that like half a billion.
Exactly. We're trying, like one of the films we're trying to raise money for right now, our budget is 300,000, and that is like, in the grand scheme of films, that's a very low budget. In the grand scheme of Kelton's life, my life, I've never seen that money. I've never seen that number before. Like, I'm like, how is that? The world doesn't have that much money. Like, it's so
relative. When you hear someone talking about the film, it's just like $5 million budget. It's nothing.
I'm like, what? Yeah, I'm like, that's crazy. Like, where did that come from? And especially with like the big studios, it's like, and also what was that spent on? Which is like kind of really interesting, but yeah.
Yeah, I think that's something that's also been discussed at large recently, because some of the films are just not being affordable, and like when you need $1 billion just to break even, it's not working. And I think that people are slowly peeling back and going back to the stories that are being told. Now there's just something intimate. You can still have a huge story, but you need to set it in a way that's not just like all show and nothing of the substance. So I think people are slowly realizing that. And I think, of course, superhero blockbusters have their space, but still there is difference between something that was made like 5-10 years ago and now, and I've seen that like a trend that's slowly increasingly seeing indie authors such as yourself like taking up space, because people are kind of fed up with some of the stuff that's been popular.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
Yeah, and circling back to your work, as I said, the first one that I saw is a horror, short horror. Hopefully, we'll someday see a feature. But What Found Me in the Woods at a Night Like Tonight? I think I got that right.
It's a mouthful, and I have not heard the end of it from like my friends and the cast and everything. They always give me a hard time about it, and like, yeah, it's probably not the most. It's probably not the most useful when like trying to search for it online and stuff, which probably bit me in the butt. But like, I love long, weird titles, because on some level also it sticks with you, because you're like, what is that one weird long ass, you know, whatever. So What Found Me in the Woods on a Night Like Tonight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's evocative. I think that like that's something that's more, again, visible in the fantasy realm. With writing, a lot of people have been bunching on the trend, like this of the dead, like Crown of Thorns of the Prince of something.
Yeah.
And I think that this one is kind of a step forward from the, we had a short trend of It Something, or just like It Follows, It Came at Night, stuff like that.
And yeah,
this kind of reminded me of that, but kind of a more broad
term. Yeah, like, and, oh my gosh, so many letters.
Yeah, so when I saw that, like, I saw a recommendation, somebody's profile, and I took a look, and it was kind of shocking to me that when I saw that this was like such a small production, and that like you don't have dozens of short films under your belt already. Oh. I mean, published, you have a lot of work behind that, but and as I saw, you got a couple of rewards for that. Awards, you got SoCal Film Awards, Alt FF.
Yeah.
So, walk us through that. How did that project came by, and like how the process of applying to festivals went? Like timeline for that.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, this was such a fun one. So this was our first, you know, really big one. My very first one that I did was Folding In, which was like that sci-fi romance one, and then we did this one take that was like really like a micro short film, and then this was our big one, and we've done several after this, but this was our one that like really, I think we wanted to prove, you know, we can, you know, make something on a very small budget, funded by like, I, it was just, you know, completely funded by me, and you know, so we had to work on a very small budget, and so this was our first big one, and this came about by, first off, a relationship with a friend of mine. I have this dear friend Marty, and he and I try to get coffee once every few weeks. And two or three years ago, we were talking. It must have like happened right after Christmas, and we were getting coffee. And we were talking about the Christmas season, and he was talking about how he went to a party with his wife, his now wife, and there was a white elephant gift exchange happening, and everyone was exchanging, you know, fun things like a wine bottle or I don't know, wine opener. I don't know why all my suggestions have alcohol, probably booze on the brain. No, so, you know, little fun things like that. Well, Marty decided, well, Marty's a great, he's so funny, and he's a really weird guy, and he was like, well, I'm gonna like do something different, and he had found, I don't know, I think it was like the skull of a skunk or something on the road. And so he ended up making this twig figure with this skull of this skunk. And he gave that as the gift during White Elephant. And so everyone's opening these gifts and they're like, oh, this is so fun, and blah, blah, blah. And then they open this gift and they're like, what the heck is this? This is wild. And he was telling me the story, and with it came a part of the note. What we read in the short film, that first half is part of the note that Marty had written, and it came with that. And they were so weirded out by that. And Marty's telling me the story, and I was like, oh my god! First off, this is hilarious, and second, this is like a really cool idea. Imagine a group of friends getting together and they're all opening fun gifts, but then one of them opens this really weird gift. And imagine if it's not from someone. Imagine if they have no idea how the gift got in there, And it's like this weirdly cryptic, prophetic parchment paper with this totem, and it's really weird. And from there, you know, I asked him, I was like, hey, can I like go with this and can I like kind of create a story off this? And he was like, go for it. And so then I started writing these characters and whatnot. And then it got into, okay, what does it represent? And who are these characters? And it was important to me that the characters were all friends who try to uphold this tradition. But the more you go with the short film, the more you realize, oh, they're like, they should not be friends anymore. Life has clearly brought them apart, but they feel like they have to stay together. And that was really interesting. And then having the creature outside the cabin and all that stuff. So that's how it came to be. And then the shoot was 3 days, and cast and crew were incredible with these short films. And I'm sure with features as well. Talent and ability is so important, but what is almost just as important are the people who are willing to do it with you. And these are long hours. For that film, we did night shoots. And then during the day, we slept at this Airbnb, but like the Airbnb had floor-to-ceiling windows that couldn't be covered up. So I'm trying to get my cast and crew to sleep while the sun's rising, and like the sun's in their eyes. And they're all so patient and so loving, so lovely. And so that was the shoot, and the shoot was a lot of fun. And then, yeah, I had a great post-production team, and they edited that. And that was shot by a DP friend of mine, Anton Axton, who's incredible. And then it was edited by Zach Bender, who I mentioned earlier. And yeah, that was really fun. And it was, like I said earlier, you know, there are three films there. The one that we wrote, the one that we shot, and then the one that, you know, Zach kind of put together. And it was awesome. And so, yeah, we took that and then we started submitting it in festivals. And I think what's difficult about that one, just to be completely, you know, transparent, is it's about, I don't know, 13 to 15 minutes long, something like that. And it's not, when you go on YouTube and you go to like horror short films, you're looking at like 5 to 7 minute films, sometimes 10 minute, but they're like right away. The horror's there right away. There's like a jump scare or there's a whatever. This is 15 minutes of, it never goes full blown jump scare. It's more about the atmosphere. It's about this like really comforting atmosphere that starts to degrade into a more spooky, creepy thing as you start to get a look in these people's minds and start to realize, oh, these characters are like not good. And these characters are not good to each other and they're not good to themselves. And then he pulls the gift and he pulls the note and we have this long shot of him reading the note. And so it's much more a atmospheric film and it's much more a creepy film and not like, here's the monster right away. It's more about building. And I think that's a little bit harder to sell when on YouTube or on festivals and stuff, when you're kind of submitting for horror, because it's much more like, it's a longer commitment. And so we were fortunate to get into the festivals we did. And that was a lot of fun and, a lot of definitely, you know, rejection. And that's for every one festival you get into, you get rejected by 5 others. And that's just the name of the game. And I'm so blessed to be in the festival that we were put into, and our feedback on YouTube has been great. All the comments, the majority of the comments are, where's the feature? We know, which is very exciting and very encouraging. And so I'm actually working on that right now and writing that one, because there's definitely much more story to tell. So that's kind of the journey of What Found Me in the Woods on a Night Like Tonight. Or if you don't want to spend 5 minutes saying the title, What Found Me in the Woods.
Yeah, and do you already know where the story would go after that for a feature?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I do know, and I'm really excited, because when you watch the short, you start to realize like, oh, this is like about the characters, and that's the richness of the feature. It's a bigger breakdown of the characters, and it's really showing their chemistry with one another. And then the third act, the creature's certainly there. The creature's certainly a threat, but what is more of a threat are their relationships to one another and these pent-up aggressions they have towards one another and this obligation they feel, and they really test their friendship. And so there's a lot to go there. And one of the things about short films, we only have 15 minutes to tell a story, and I want to get a look into these characters' heads. And so we have those cutaways. We have those three cutaways where we like cut away to characters arguing about something. And that's really cool. But you have to be a little expository in that with short films, because you're like, I have to get this information out to the audience right away, because we only have a short amount of time. So I need to show that that Dom is struggling with the group. I have to show that Greg has anger management issues and that Julie doesn't feel safe. I have to show these things. So I have to be a little expository with that. With a film, with a feature, you can be a little bit more nuanced, and you can be a little bit more subtle, and you can hint at that and build it up over a longer time. And so that when it bursts, it's a really big, burst that's kind of justified. And so, yeah, working on that right now, and have the first pass done, and I'm slowly working on the second one. Because the first pass is just, as I'm sure you know, and as I'm sure all the writers you've interviewed know more than I, the first pass is just getting it on the page. I'm like, okay, just get it on the page, and then we'll go through it, and we'll comb through it, and we'll polish this thing. So working on that right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see it becoming a feature for sure. And as a lot of mm-hmm. people commented, we can't wait to see it, because yeah. I think that's one of the differences that you put it well. When you look at, I saw a lot of shorts on YouTube, and a lot of them feel like creepypastas, like there's mm-hmm. your punchline very fast and like, that's about it. And I think that this one resonated because it's a slow burn, which isn't that often with shorts. Switching back to another one that you mentioned, you mm-hmm. also done a sci-fi / romance. That's interesting combination. It's mm-hmm. called Folding In, and you also got some awards for that one as well. And it was interesting for me seeing that a couple people commented on that they didn't get it at all.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
how did that feel?
Yeah, it felt good. It felt fine. Because the ending, he comes out of this thing, and this couple in order to kind of talk about this, I have to like open the can of worms of the film, but it's like in the beginning you have this couple who the girl wants to be more than just this random hookup, and the guy is not ready for that. Then all of a sudden, halfway through the film, something happens, and all of a sudden the guy wants the relationship and the girl doesn't. And of course it was like this look at, timing with relationships, and about how that's so sad how some people can just be on separate pages, and then they might be really good for each other, and they could have worked, but the timing is different. And so the thing that we have happen halfway through the film distorts time. And you have these characters trying to make sense of what's happened. And people commenting that they didn't really understand it was fine, because the characters don't understand it. And from the very beginning, we're in the characters' heads. We never have this moment where they go, oh my gosh, this happened because of this, and XYZ happened, and this, so this means this is like a time distortion, or this means this is a different dimension, or whatever, because we are only getting information that the characters are getting, that Hansen is getting. And so, Hansen and Libby, and so they don't know. All Hansen knows now, because of this time distortion, is that the woman that he just thought he spent years loving is walking out that door, and he's never going to see her again. And he's so confused. And that's the point of the film is the relationship between the two of them. Not necessarily what happened when he went through that door, because when he comes out of that door, he's scrambling to know what happened. He's scrambling to explain. He's like, I don't know. It was, different dimensions, time travel, and he's confused. And then the confusion boils down to them talking about their relationship. And it's kind of like the film being like, here's a really big, crazy idea, but then let's boil it down to the point of the film are these two people not being aligned, and her walking away, and a relationship having to break, and him having to feel that heartbreak, even though in the film, it was just a few minutes ago that he didn't want this, but now he wants it, and he's had it for several years, and he's not getting it anymore. So Yeah, we kept it. I wanted to keep what was kind of behind the door very distorted and only have glimpses of what it could have been, whether it be time travel, whether it be, you know, whatever in my head. And the title says what I believe it is, which is, he says, reality is folding in on each other. And so that Hamzin, he walks out of that room. He's wearing the same shirt as the one that we watched go in there, except now he has a mustache that he somehow grew within seconds. And so we purposely did that because I purposely wanted to imply that it was the dimensions folding in on each other. And this is a singular Hamzin who's just a mix of these different Hamzins folding in. So that's kind of what I, you know, believe. But again, it's totally fine, you know, that people are, you know, confused because the characters are confused. And the point is the heartbreak. But there again, that's such a learning experience where just on the being authentic or being transparent, there's absolutely a world where I tell that story better in coming years and be a little bit more clear, or point the audience a little bit more in this direction, because we always need to be learning from our creations. And so while I'm happy that, you know, there was confusion, that was kind of the point with the characters, we definitely learned a lot. So it was really great feedback.
Yeah, and when you think about it, you mentioned, it comes to mind, you said the heartbreak as a team and their relationship, and looking back at the previous one that we talked about and the relationship within those mm-hmm. characters, and now when you also mentioned the one that's basically one take, Ode mm-hmm. for Malone, is that right, Malone? Is that
the Ode from Malum, or probably okay. Malone. I'm not the hair say on, I'm not the ultimate say on that pronunciation.
It's interesting because that has also a strong theme of like heartbreak and relationship in it, mm-hmm. and it's like interesting seeing your different takes on that, like exploring them from different sides, like this one is more horror, this one is kind of a sci-fi, this one is mm-hmm. basically almost experimental in a way. It's we're just like, and how was creating that? Because you basically wrote a monologue there, because we only see the character just like listening to a message or listening to music while the message plays. It's also mm-hmm. you can take it either way. Yep. So how was creating that type of like feeling there? Did you start from also the relationship part, or maybe from the music? How did that
turn? Yeah, so I think I originally started from that. I originally started that idea because I wanted to, this sounds really bad and this might not ethically be correct, but I essentially wanted to feel like I wanted to tell something really short that made the audience feel like they'd been lied to in a really brutal way. And so that's where the idea stemmed from. And then so then I started thinking, okay, well, what if it's this film about this guy dancing and he's dancing and he's kind of being weird and people and I want the audience kind of be like laughing at him, like, what is this? But as they're getting more clues, they're starting to realize, oh, we shouldn't be laughing here. This is not funny. This is actually like really dangerous. And this is a really dangerous spot to be in. And I feel bad for kind of like laughing and kind of like chuckling in the beginning. And so that was kind of my intention behind it. So, yeah, we had done the dance, and then it's this woman leaving this voicemail for this guy who's clearly grieving, and you get context through the voicemail that, you know, he's been broken up with, he's a recovering alcoholic, he's prone to jealousy, he's prone to fits, and then as we pull out, we see that this house that we thought was in order has been destroyed, and like he's thrown furniture and everything, and we're only catching him at the end of his freak out. So that was my intention, and that's how we found it. And then the DP on that, Arthur Gregorian, he was incredible with like the mood lighting and the moonlight coming in and everything. And so that was another one where I want it to be subtly horrific. You think, oh, it's just a 4-minute film about a guy dancing. Okay, I'll watch it. And at the very end, really, really being fearful for the woman who's going to come check up on him, and being fearful for him, and being like, oh, these are bad characters put in bad places. And So that was kind of how we found it. It was, the original idea was, okay, I want to deceive the audience, and hopefully they'll be okay with that, and then leave them with this moment of like, ugh, like the silence, you know, the credits we have, like we have the credits flash on the screen and then they disappear pretty quickly, and it's just darkness, because I just want the audience to sit with what they just witnessed, and be uneasy by that. So that's kind of where we found it. Mm-hmm. And the actor who was in Folding In, who I play opposite of, Melanie Johnson, she was the voice on that one, and that was a lot of fun because Folding In is such a fun, charming film, and this one was so moody, and so it was a good time, her and I fulfilling different roles in that film.
And when you write a character and you know you'll portray someone, how does that feel? I can imagine that it's different when you write for somebody else and you just think about a character. Can you separate yourself from the art, literally?
Yeah, that's great. I really hope I can, because the characters that I'm being, like with Greg from What Found Me in the Woods, he struggles with anger management. Benny from Ode from Malum, he struggles with alcoholism, all those things. Definitely hope those aren't character traits on my end. But so there are those obvious things that are certainly different. But then there is the, I came up here to LA as an actor, and I took a lot of, you know, acting classes, and what they did is they helped us really create stories for the character in the scene, and what was your prior instinct and who are you? And that was such a practice in building it. And so with these characters, I was able to, even though it's like me writing for a character for myself, I don't allow anything in my own life to impact that character. I just build from scratch. And I might feel the same sorrow in my personal life as this character feels about this, but I have to make sure it's like because of a different reason and whatnot. And so there's definitely similarities, but I try to shape a different characters for my own. And that's tough sometimes, especially like, again, you know, being very transparent, shooting film, you're on not only a money budget, but you're on like a time budget, you know, oh, we have to get this shot because of, we can't go over. So there are many times where I've built the character, I've written this character for myself, and I built this whole backstory that's not Kelton's backstory, it's a different backstory. However, I know I'm only going to be able to get to that moment if I rely on Kelton's backstory. And so I kind of compromise and I dismiss that and I fail that technique, because I have to get to this moment. And so those are ways that I want to learn and I want to grow and I want to get better at being able to rely more on those fictional stories that I've created for myself rather than relying on my own. But it's just really tough when, you know, you're down to, you know, oh, this has got to be the last take and you have to cry or you have to feel this way. Sometimes I do have to rely on my own. So that's really interesting. And then when writing, because I think I've spent so much time writing my own characters for myself, when I write characters for others, I really want to make sure it's a collaborative effort. And so the actors and actresses we bring in, I want to make sure that there's this open line of dialogue. And that if something doesn't sit right with them or whatever, there's this collaborative atmosphere that so that they can contribute and be like, oh, what if I said it this way? Or actually, I don't think this character would do this because of what we've already established over here. And I think that's so valuable. I try to be smart enough to know that I'm not the smartest person in the room. To be like, what I say should not be law. Like, let's bring in this actor's opinion, and have that shape the character as well. As the writer, as long as my original motivation and intention is still intact, I still want to get to, you know, Z, but however we get from A to Z, that might look different for the other actor. And I really wanted to respect that. So.
And which one changed the most from your original vision to the finished product?
I think probably what changed the most, there's a film that we have coming out called An Acknowledgement of Services, and that's like a supernatural mystery. And that one definitely has changed the most, because of in a lot of great ways. The DP for that one, Riley Donovan, he came in even at an early stage and even helped me with the script, and that was so helpful. And then our editor, again, Zach Bender, he had great advice on the editing floor, and so that definitely changed a lot in such awesome ways. I'm so proud of that one, and so I'm really excited for people to see that one. That one probably changed the most.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And yeah. When you mentioned something that's coming up, you also talked a couple of times about your horror western. That's something that's unfortunately yet to happen, but for me that was interesting seeing that, and you had some issues with the production, but that mesh of genres, of setting and genre, is interesting because we did have some of them, but I think it's still underused as a setting for horror, so that could be interesting. Did you see Bone Tomahawk?
Yeah, oh, I love Bone Tomahawk. I saw that with my father years ago, and it was great. Brutal. It's really brutal, especially towards the end. But it was really good. Yeah, Kurt Russell's awesome in it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For me, that came to mind because I saw that you posted about some special effects that we're doing and makeup that need to be done for that. So I can imagine you'll have some brutality in that as well, opposed to some of the other things you've done so far.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. There's definitely some brutality to that. And like you said, that we've put that on pause because we're still trying to line up schedules, and I've learned to have a lot of irons in the fire and still make sure they're all still simmering, because something might happen where, oh, we can take this iron out now and now we can use it. I don't even know if that's how the analogy works, but, so that's one of the ones that we still have cooking, because the moment the DP and I schedule lines up, we're off to the races and we're doing this thing. So yeah, we're really excited about that one. Yeah, that had some special effects as well, and that one's really exciting because I think that is all about, it's the mix of Gothic and Western, and we want to really break down masculinity and also like love between brothers and whatnot, which I think would be really beautiful, just this unashamed love, especially I don't know if you see brotherly love shown a lot in films and in such an unapologetic way, in this old school, like just embrace, love one another kind of way. And so we're really excited about that one, and we still want to try to get that one up and going.
And how that came about, like, did you imagine a way where you could tell that story and like the contrast with the masculinity of the Westerns and stuff like that came to mind, or you've done something that's like you wanted to do something that's set in those times and you then figured out the story, which came first?
Yeah, that's great. So two things happened kind of like simultaneously, and neither of them have to do with both of them have to do with like other people's work, which is like so fun. I really enjoy that. I'm just so inspired by other people's art. And actually that was inspired by, I saw an Instagram edit about a year ago. I saw this Instagram edit of this mashup between like the Gothic, they call it like Gothic Western, I guess it's like a subgenre. And it was just this quick reel, like this quick 10-second reel of like showing abandoned gas stations and neon signs. And it was just so cool. The way it was edited, I was like, that's really cool. And I remember I had like saved it on Instagram because I was like, that was just like so aesthetically really fun to watch and really pleasing. And then around the same time, I listened to this music. There was a song called Debris by Lorne. And I highly recommend it. It's like, it's only like 3 minutes long. It's just very atmospheric. And I remember I would go on every night. I take these walks and I'm in this like, you know, little dingy LA apartment, but I'll walk across the street where these like really pretty one story houses are. And every night I'll go over there and I'll walk and I'll listen to music. And one night my Spotify just pulled this up and it was so moody and it was so atmospheric. And right away I imagined this vet, this ex-marine walking across landscape, and he's got this old ritual book, and he's got this you know, vial of blood, and I started just imagining it as the music was playing, and it was truly the music that just conjured up these images. And then it was like, okay, well, why is he going out to this certain place with this like ritual book and this vial of blood? What deal is he making? Why is he making that deal? Who is he? And that's where all the other stuff started coming from. But really the inspiration was from those two things, like other people's art, which inspired this, which I think is just so cool. Another example of that, this is kind of a tangent, but another example of that is an acknowledgement of services, the one I mentioned earlier. There's this great scene where the character starts crying behind this glass pane, and you can only like kind of make him out. And there's like symbolism behind that. And that was the very first shot I imagined of that short film. And that was because I was watching a film a few years ago, and there was a scene where a character walked behind a glass pane, and they were just retrieving something, and they walked out, and it was only 2 seconds long. But in my head, it was immediately like, oh, a really cool shot would be like a character stepping behind that and crying, and like almost like they're trying to hide from the audience, but we can still kind of see them. And then that's what turned into an acknowledgement of services. And so it's really fun, just the different ways we get inspired by other people's art.
And what are some other things that inspire you? You've obviously, well, influenced by horror and different types of it, but also you've, as we mentioned, dabbled in a lot of different genres. We can see Hannibal poster behind you.
Hannibal poster?
Also saw the Batman, the latest Batman so far, the Pattinson one. That was Batman versus Superman.
Yeah, I have a BVS poster as BVS, well. Yeah.
So a bit of that. So how do those mash together? What are some things that you would cite like as your huge influences or inspirations?
Yeah. I got my whole room is decorated with posters, because what I do is when I'm like having writer's block, I'll just take a second, I'll just look at them, and then they kind of inspire me. So they're all over the place. But So other things. There's even different media. I really enjoy reading, but I'm a huge gamer. I think video games tell such beautiful and complex and intricate stories, and so that really inspires me. I am really, really inspired by films that, I mean, I have a lot of, you know, blockbuster films and whatnot, but very aesthetically interesting films that like you look at a shot and you're like, oh, I know that shot is from this kind of person's film, and that's all, that always really inspires me. And I think this is, you know, this might not answer the question, I'm not sure, but growing up I was a huge nerd. I loved video games and painting models and fantasy and all that stuff. And I remember as a kid, especially in like high school and stuff, when like you just wanted, you know, the attention of a cute girl or something, you would hide that away. And now it's all that stuff comes up, and now it's being unashamedly in love with that, which is so cool. And what an awesome time. Like, what a great time right now it is. Like, I feel like the world is so open to that stuff now. And so all that stuff is resurging. And so my inspiration is certainly movies and aesthetically interesting movies. And you know, some of my favorites, my favorite storytellers are, you know, Guillermo del Toro. I think his sincerity is amazing. So I you know, certainly take inspiration from movies, but even video games or I have models that I'll sometimes, when I just need a break and I just need to zone out and try to figure out some plot hole in my mind or something, I'll just sit and I'll paint these Lord of the Rings models. Yeah, I take inspiration from all over, really.
Yeah, that's interesting. But as you mentioned, like, that things have come around, and like when you see like Henry Cavill talking about his Warhammer figures, yeah, you can't say that stuff is for nerds only. So
totally, exactly, pumped exactly.
In the air when I saw that interview, I was like, yes,
he's paved the way for us, and we're like, oh, you are our hero. Yeah. Now we just have to work on getting his physique. Seems like we still have his mentality. Yeah, that's the easier part. Yeah.
And what are some of the games that you like? I can imagine that you don't have too much time for that because you're quite busy with your stuff. But what are some things that come to mind?
Yeah. You know, I'm certainly busy, but I genuinely do try to Like, I purposefully make room for that, because when I play a game, I'm not really, I don't play many like multiplayer games or MMOs or whatnot. Multiplayer, but or live service games. So those don't take up much of my time. But what I do is I play a lot of campaign and narrative driven games. I play, of course, as everyone and their mother loves, you know, The Last of Us, and that was such a pivotal game for me growing up, and the Sony's new God of War, this story where it takes this fanciful character but brings it into such an intimate level where it's just about him and his relationship with his son. So very narrative driven games, and I purposely take time to play them, because while it certainly feels recreational, I'm still learning. I think I'm watching people at the height of their craft create stories, and I'm always consuming in an educational way. I'm like, oh, that really worked because of this, and that feeds me, and then I get even more inspired. And so yeah, I try to take time to play games so that I am inspired, but then also I'm still getting educated. I feel like I'm still learning from these people who are at the top of their craft. And right now I'm still in Baldur's Gate 3, because that is quite the expansive game. So I'm working through that right now. But yeah, it's a nice balance. It's a nice dichotomy of like being a break from work, but then also still kind of getting inspired for work, which I really love.
For sure. I'm still mm-hmm. scared to get into that, because I know it will eat up like 100 hours like that.
Baldur's Gate?
Yeah, Baldur's Gate.
Oh my gosh, yeah. It's crazy. I'm like 54 hours in, and I'm not even in like the final act yet. And yeah, it's great. But yeah, say goodbye to your social life.
For sure. And especially seeing like we talked about the resurgence of that stuff, and like being like a nerd when you were younger, mm-hmm. and that stuff being more in the spotlight now, and especially when you think about Baldur's Gate being so big, but also like D&D and RPGs, collaborative storytelling has also gotten a new life on YouTube and other platforms, and for me it's mm-hmm. so interesting seeing people create stories in that way, and people engaging with them in that way. For me, that's kind of a whole new way of experiencing stories that we've seen just like past 5 years or so.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a completely new way, and it's becoming legitimate. It's like a legitimate way now. And which it always was, but now people are really seeing this is like really resourceful, and people who play. I've only played like maybe like one or I think like two games of D&D, and I was really bad at it, and I really want to get back into it. But these are people who are able to weave stories so quickly, and like they're working that muscle, and so of course they're really gonna get good at it. And those are the people I want to see behind these huge Hollywood fantasy. You know, I don't want to see these people who have no appreciation for the source material, or these people who have no. You know, they didn't grow up this way, but they're like, oh, I just got this job, and you know, here's a trend chasing. But it's like, I want to like put the people who, if you put a D&D DM as a showrunner on some fantasy show, like that would be crazy. I'm sure it would be amazing. So those are definitely legitimate avenues now, which are so cool, and I'm really excited about that.
Agreed. That's a good point. And yeah, before I let you go, I would mm-hmm. like to hear what you have in store in the future. You mentioned a couple of things, definitely the Western one, we'll be looking out for that. Uh-huh. But what are your some kind of midterm plans? Let's not go so far as like 10 years, but what can you expect in the next coming period, whatever that may mean for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're still trying to get that short up and running, but right now a lot of my attention has been put towards this feature that we're going to shoot. I'm prepping for two features right now, and one has a bigger budget. One's the $300,000 budget I was telling you about, which we're so excited about, and we're really going through all the right avenues and all the professional avenues for that. But that's just such a work in progress, and we're really struggling with that. Just, you know, which is expected, and that's okay, and it'll be so worth it when we pull that off. But in the meantime, a small team and I are working on another feature, which is a romantic comedy horror, another weird mesh of genres, and we're going to shoot that like middle of April, and so mid to late April. And so right now we're really just focused on getting ready for that. We have done several passes of the script. This is going to be a really small budget feature, but it'll be really, really sweet, really sad, and really beautiful. And right now I'm just working on the Seed and Spark campaign. So that's going to go up in the next few days. Right after this call, I'm going to be editing our pitch video for it. And so that's going to be up soon. Because we want to, like we were talking about earlier with Kickstarter and whatnot, we want to kind of go through that avenue and see what we can raise and bring people on that are excited about it. And so that's what we have coming up next. And that film will be called It's Presence Between Us. It's Presence Between Us. And I tried to keep the title a little bit shorter this time. So just four words. That's where all of our energy is going to, and I'm writing it with a co-writer, and then I'll direct it, and then also be acting in that as well. It's just a way to stay creative and to keep the juices flowing, especially as the city, LA and Hollywood, they're it's really struggling right now. And as an LA resident, I'm feeling that, and so I just want to keep on top of things and try to find ways to keep myself creating and all the people that are in my circle creating. So yeah, It's Presence Between Us is our next feature, and we will be launching the Seed and Spark campaign for that really soon, and flooding everybody's social medias with that, which we'll try not to be annoying with it, but you know, no promises. So
that's a great point to end on, and I'm sure we'll enjoy everything that comes, and of course we'll be keeping an eye out, and I'm sure that it will find its audience. So yeah, it's been great hearing about your journey, and I can't wait to see what's next in the store. So yeah, I wish you all the luck with it, and thank you for coming on to Storyline Sessions.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Same. Bye, Kelton.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Storyline Sessions podcast. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. You can find Kelton and his work via the links in the description. If you're interested in creative writing in any kind of media, keep following the Storyline Sessions, both here and on Instagram. My name is Marko Bogdanović, and I'll see you next time. Keep creating stories.